I'm Don Landis. I'm an alcoholic. If you can hear me, just give me a thumbs up so I know the audio's working. Fantastic. Well, first things first, I want to thank my friend Billy H. for the kind invitation to come and participate in your meeting this evening. I don't take the honor and privilege of doing things in Alcoholics Anonymous lightly, and certainly wonderful, particularly in these uncertain, trying times. I'll let you know that I live in Bellingham, Washington, which if you don't know where that is, don't feel bad. We're go to Seattle, you know, and then go about 100 miles north. Stop about 20 miles before the Canadian border, and you'll be in Bellingham. I don't know, America's first defense against Canada, I suppose. We're right up there near the Canadian border, and we've probably had as strict requirements during this pandemic as anywhere in the country. So I haven't met in a face-to-face meeting in Bellingham since March. And so I'm very grateful for these opportunities to participate, not just in my home group and the local meetings that we all have this platform, but also being able to travel around the world and travel around the country and be able to be with you fine folks on a, you know, Sunday afternoon for me, Sunday evening for you, to see my friend Peter from Australia. What a pleasant surprise to see your smiling, handsome face. You look far too good for a man your age. And just kidding, Peter. You're young. You're young, I know. And the flip side of that is, Jerry, you should look better at your age. And Jerry, my good friend Jerry Sinatra. And, you know, we get to have that, you know, that camaraderie that really, it. You know, I think this is why I like the format, because it really is what AA is about, right? What do we say about AA? What do we say about the realm of the spirit? Broad, roomy, and inclusive, never exclusive. And I think if there's ever been anything that's been broad, roomy, and inclusive, it's this platform. And I've heard a lot of people have a lot of problems with this. I have not. I've seen the value in it. And I thought to myself, maybe this will be just another arrow, you know, in that spiritual quiver, that spiritual kit of tools that we can take with us when we return to some form of normalcy where we're all able to travel and get together that we're so used to eyeball, elbow to elbow, going out to dinner, hanging out in the parking lot for an hour after the meeting, all that stuff I miss so desperately. You know, I miss the stuff before the meeting and after the meeting, just that's the good stuff. You know what I mean? Taking each other's inventory, you know, walking into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to that electricity, that beehive-like buzz, you know, and you can just close your eyes and let it wash over you. You know, the music of AA, everybody talking, not one person listening, you know, and that's AA. That's the good stuff where we come together and we just have that energy. But I think about the single mother with kids, and I think about somebody that's elderly or somebody that doesn't drive at night anymore. And I think about this platform. Mm-hmm. And I have friends in AA that fit those criteria, and they're going to more meetings, being exposed to more message, more God, more step workshops, more conferences than they've ever experienced in their sobriety. And what they've learned is that, wow, I can do this so conveniently. And I don't have to get a babysitter for the kids. I don't have to find somebody to pick me up and give me a ride to the meeting. You know, I can go. And then there's people that work those crazy shifts. They're working at night and then they're working in the day. And they never know what their hours are going to be. And they've got this great arsenal that no matter what time of day it is, because there's an AA meeting all over the world somewhere, they can jump on and they can get the message carried to them. So God bless this format. I don't know where we'd be without it. And I'm having it's an interesting time because my life is exactly the same as before the pandemic, yet everything's really changed. There's some things that are very different, but everything's the same. I'm still sober. God bless that I'm still sober since September 16th, 1991, the most outstanding fact of my life. 29 years sober, card-carrying AA member, meat and potatoes, nothing fancy. I ain't much, but I'm all I think about. You know what I mean? I love AA, and I have no qualms about saying why I'm sober for this length of time, which is I've had nothing to do with the solution. I have supplied the willingness, the one thing that you can't give me. You can give me experience, strength, and hope, till it comes out of my ears. You can give me all the beautiful literature we have at our disposal. You can give me over 80 years of collective experience. You can give me a great home group and a great sponsor and great friends and great commitments and all these tools that I can use for a guy like me to resurrect my life in a spiritual realm called Alcoholics Anonymous. But without my willingness, we're not moving, are we? We're not going anywhere. And that's the one thing I've been able to supply. But the rest was supplied by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for God's sakes, the power that we talk about endlessly here, that loving God that you introduced me to, which curiously enough, I didn't believe in when I got here. Isn't that good news for the atheist or the agnostic who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, that Bill thought enough to be honest about that, and we agnostics, where he wrote, don't feel bad, about half of our original membership was just like that. And when you read that, you go, well, it's okay. I don't have to leave. I don't have to leave a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous and go die a mad dog death, because at this particular moment, being brand new at the low point of my existence, I didn't believe in God. You said, that's okay. Come on in. Sit with us. You know, what a welcoming, warm place AA was for a guy like me. I've had nothing to do with the solution. And what I mean by that is that the raw material that I bring to Alcoholics Anonymous with me, the quality of that material, has anything to do with a successful outcome? I'm a dead man. You know what I mean? Because my scorecard reads zero. My tank's on empty, right? I have nothing to contribute. What do I bring to AA when I'm new? Right? Except fierce resentment, fear, old ideas, and prejudice. That's what I got. That's what I'm living my life. What's my propulsion system, right? I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. And that's who walked into AA. So let's be clear. I can't take credit for the good life I have. But I'm so grateful to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous that you've given me and shown me and taking me by the hand, and in a shoulder-to-shoulder, eyeball-to-eyeball method, you have taught me how to live this way of life in all of my affairs. And it's a funny thing about AA that I know to be true. And I know there might be somebody listening tonight who's struggling. Maybe you're new to AA. Maybe you're not quite sure if this is for you. And that's okay. That's why we don't ask you to sign anything. You know, the door swings both ways here. But I'll tell you the good news that for me, about AA. Alcoholics Anonymous does not work because of the alcoholic. AA works in spite of the alcoholic. In spite of all those things I told you I brought to the program, the spiritual apparatus, this power that we talk about, cuts through all of that, cuts through that prejudice, those resentments, that fear. And it leaves you with a feeling that you can't deny, because you can't deny the truth. And it's not an intellectual thought. It's a feeling when you're new in AA. And if you're new, don't deny that feeling you have, because you might have the same feeling I had very, very early in my recovery, which is this. I think this thing could work for a guy like me, and I had no reason to believe it. I hadn't been here long enough. I didn't have the experience. I didn't have eyes that could see or a heart that could feel. And what had I been doing for 5, 6 years before AA but taking all of my human power and doing battle with King Alcohol? You know, I got sober when I was 31. At 25, I had self-knowledge, you know, and the problem with self-knowledge is it kills alcoholics, because it feels important, doesn't it? When finally it's not your mom, your dad, your husband, your wife, the arresting officer, your doctor, your employer. It's not your friends. It's you and your own voice in your own head going, I got to stop drinking or I'm going to die. And you go click and you get it, and the light bulb goes on, and it went on for me. And I remember thinking, God, they've been talking to me about my drinking for years, and they were right. And now I agree with them. And it felt this self-knowledge that the booze was killing me and I had to stop. This self-knowledge about the trouble that it was causing in my life felt like some type of a solution, felt like I was going to be able to stop drinking based on that change of head and change of heart that I had that self-knowledge produces. And I knew that I was going to stop drinking, and it wasn't going to be a big deal, because that's what you do when you're a man and you find out you have a problem with something. You don't ask for help. You don't tear, you know, with tears in your eyes, go tell, you just knock it off. Just knock it off, right? And so I just knocked off drinking. I didn't come to AA. And I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't get a home group. I didn't work your 12 golden steps. And I quit drinking alcohol without you. Thank you very much. When I was 25 years old, I did that for, oh, I don't know, 2 weeks. And boy, you find out a lot that first shot at sobriety, don't you? You know, that idea that this isn't going to be a big deal suddenly goes, uh-oh. Because I had every reason to quit drinking at 25. I had enough failure. I had enough consequence, enough broken dreams, broken hearts, and skinned knuckles, enough billboard-sized neon-lit information that said I shouldn't drink. I had it all on board at 25, and I went 2 weeks, and here's the funny thing about the 2 weeks. A lot of damage gets done in that 2 weeks, and here's the damage. I got a family that loves me. Maybe you do too, and my family have been watching me die by inches for years. And suddenly I have self-knowledge, and I do what most of us do. I made that alcoholic declaration. I'm quitting drinking. It's all going to be different. And unbeknownst to me, my family's been having those backroom meetings about yours truly. What are we going to do about Donald? He's drinking himself to death. He's going to jail. He's crashing cars. He's blowing through jobs and relationships. What are we going to do? He's on a fast path to the graveyard. What are we going to do? And they're wringing their hands in despair, and they don't know what to do. And they look at each other, and they go, God, when we talk to him, he laughs it off or he gets angry. I mean, if he doesn't get it, he doesn't get it. What can we do? But when I could quit drinking with self-knowledge and I look my family in the eye and say, I'm quitting, I'm not lying. You know, I've quit drinking 100 times. I want to be clear about this. I've never lied. You know, but I didn't understand. There's no room for the truth where alcoholism is played out. So when my family heard me say that, they believed me. They could tell I was telling the truth. And I did to my family one of the cruelest things an alcoholic of my type could do to their family. You see, I gave them false hope because I didn't understand what I was in the clutches of. I mean, my family doesn't understand alcoholism, and I'm the sufferer, and I understand it somehow even less than they do. And so they see me all lit up again 2 weeks later. And so when I took that wild ride for 5 or 6 years before I got to AA, doing everything you read about in chapter 3, you know, various vain attempts to control and enjoy my drinking, a feeling I was regaining control to find out I'd lost even more control, brief periods of recovery followed by a still worse relapse, all that stuff, I took my family with me because we don't go alone. We have that perception because I came to AA like any good newcomer singing that newcomer song. The only person I hurt was myself, but that ain't true. I tore my family up and they watched it. And if you love a guy like me and you watch one more attempt at sobriety and one more failure and one more attempt and one more failure, and you don't understand alcoholism, you might come to the conclusion my family came to. And it's got to be one of two things. One, he's a liar. Or two, he's really not trying that hard. And boy, nothing could be further from the truth, right? Because every time I quit, I'm telling the truth. And tried hard? Who tried harder than we did, right? Who tried harder than we did to break the chains that we were enslaved with? I mean, my God, don't you understand I have a front row seat for the destruction of my life? Don't you know that I wake up every morning and it's in the room with me, that thought, after I wake up to that 3 count, my head explodes with the facts of my life, the trouble in my life. And I think to myself, I am dying here. And I say that alcoholic prayer every morning, not tonight, God, not tonight. I don't know about tomorrow, but I know this. I can't drink tonight because I'm dying here. And it's a good plan on a hangover morning. You know, I'm just going to get to work, keep my head down, get through the day, go home, eat some food, and get to bed because we are dying. And every day, like clockwork, the miracle of 3 o'clock, which is after spending a whole day thinking about the failure of my life, the consequences of my life, the drinking of my life, a little voice pops in my head and says, maybe we can have a couple, but we won't go back to the bar and we won't do any of that other crap. We're just going to get a 6-pack and go home. And what I don't understand is once that thought takes hold, I've entered a period of negotiation and I always lose the negotiation. And I will be drinking that night. And I've done it 1,000 times. You don't, you know, it's not like you live that way for a week or a month or a year. You can live that way for a decade. I know. In that failure, in that alcoholic lifestyle. You know, it's an interesting thing through repetition, what we get used to. You know, the first time you go to jail, it's a big deal. It was for me, you know. Couldn't believe it. Came out of a blackout in a jail cell and thought to myself, I'm not the go-to-jail guy, man. I'm good grades in school guy, graduating class athlete guy, got a career guy. I'm not a wake-up-in-jail guy. And I was shocked and I was mortified, and I knew it would never happen again. Yeah, 10th time you come out of a blackout and you're in jail, it's a completely different vibe. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, I'm in jail. Where am I? I wonder what jail it is. God, I hope I didn't do anything too bad. And you just, here's what alcoholism will do through this repeated beating that we take at the hands of King Alcohol, right? We as a class of people begin to accept the unacceptable. We live lives that if you put a normal person in our alcoholic life, they would go for a day, just a day. They would go screaming down the street in terror. But for us, it's Tuesday. It's Friday night. It's Monday morning. Remember Monday morning? You know, it's funny. I get up some Mondays and I don't want to go to work because I'm built for leisure. It's nothing. It's not a character defect or anything like that. I'm built for leisure. You know, I've always thought it was funny when I hear somebody wins the lottery and they go, but I'm going to keep my job at the plant because I've missed the boys. I'm like, you might get a postcard. Maybe. I'm built for leisure. And I wake up some days sober, in love with my life, and I don't want to go to work. And then I remember what Mondays used to be like? Let me tell you, makes it a little easier to go to work. I always tell people, if you're having problems with gratitude, here's a trick. When you get up in the morning and you pray and meditate, get rid of that meditation book. Don't worry about the big book. Say your little morning prayer. Say good morning to God. Look at your watch and meditate for 5 minutes on what it was like. That's it. Just let that movie roll by your brain's eye for about 5 minutes. What it was like. Let me tell you, you'll snap out of that meditation and you won't wait. You couldn't wait to go, you know, meet whatever challenges you have that day, because it made me realize, you know what AA did? It put me back in the game. It put me back in the game. You know, I'm free. I can go anywhere that a free man goes, do anything that a free man does. It's remarkable. So the fact that I'm sober this length of time and free blows me away, because I'm a real alcoholic. You see, I didn't know what alcoholism was. You know, I thought there was something wrong with my morality. I thought there was something wrong with my willpower. I thought I was losing my mind. For me to continue to drink after the trouble was an almost everyday occurrence in my life. Why can't I stay away from it? But the reality is I never got sober long enough to answer that question. And I come to AA, man, and I read the doctor's opinion with a sponsor, and it starts to make sense. You know, the phenomenon of craving, the allergic reaction. I process alcohol differently. And I remember thinking, oh, that's why. That's why I'm so drunk I can't stand anymore. So I'm crawling on my hands and knees through my apartment to get into the kitchen to reach up on the counter for the jug because I need to get another drink. Why I'm consciously thinking, I can't get any drunker. I can't get any drunker. Yet I had to go crawl and get that drink. Now that makes sense to me. I start to understand the physical aspect of the disease, the mental obsession, that blank spot that my mind seems to live in, that it doesn't matter how much trouble I get in. It doesn't matter how many cars I crash, hearts I break, dreams I crush. It doesn't matter. There'll be a time, for some obscure reason, I'll forget. I'll forget what happens to the guy like me when I drink. I'll come up with some narrative or story how it's going to be different this time, or I won't even think, and I'll find myself on the wrong end of a drink in a bar going, how did I get started again? I have a mind that will always lead me back to that. And so what do? I tear my life up, and I hit a jackpot. You know what I mean? I go to jail, crash a car, bust a relationship, lose a job, and it gets my attention. You take all your human power, but you haven't been to AA. So you couldn't read in the book where it says our human power as marshaled by our will fails utterly. You don't know that. And that's all we got, right? Our human power, instincts, emotions, intellect, things that work in other areas of our life leave us dead on the battlefield of alcoholism. But we don't know that. So we try harder. we try harder. I'm going to get sober this time. And I don't know what happens to you, but something happens to me between day two and day five. I mean, day two is beautiful, right? You can finally keep some food down. You're starting to feel like you don't want to take your own life. You know, day three is not bad. You're a little bit hopeful. But somewhere between day two and day five, I noticed something. It's so slight, it's almost imperceivable, but I notice it. The color starts to leave the picture. And things start to look, I don't know, a little grayer, right? And things start to annoy me that I didn't notice before. And I start to notice there's a lot of dumb people around and a lot of inconsideration in the world. And I notice they don't appreciate me at work. And I notice that my girlfriend, she really, really should know the quality and the luck she's had in landing a guy like me. And she doesn't seem to appreciate me. And I'm not going to make a big deal of this stuff at first, but I'm noticing it. And as the days go by, more color drips out of the picture and I get more irritable. And I find myself after a couple of weeks of sobriety on my own, completely brainwashed that all I have to do is not drink and everything will be fine. Because I've been brainwashed by the people that love me the most, that told me what a great guy I am and how much potential I have and how I can do anything and all my dreams have come true if only I stopped drinking. And I believe them. So I stopped drinking again. And after a couple of weeks, the world is gray and everything pisses me off. And I'm having trouble remembering why I thought quitting drinking was a good idea. And then it happens. A little voice that sounds a lot like me pops up in my head, and it says one word, just one word, and it's the beginning of the end for a guy like me. And here's the word: forever. You're going to feel like this forever. Boy, the biggest lie my alcoholism has ever told me only tells me that lie when I'm sober, and it tells me it early in recovery when the world is gray and I can't enjoy anything. And I think all the fun is gone. It tells me I'm going to feel that way forever. And it produces a pain in me that grows on a daily basis until when I drink again, I'm not drinking to crash a car, break a heart, or go to jail. I'm drinking to overcome a mental obsession beyond my human power because I can't forget what made the big hurt go away. And it turns out I can't take the pain of sobriety. Turns out that alcohol is my solution, not my problem. That brainwashing had it backwards. Because I can't take how I feel when I'm sober. And let me tell you what, if it's not a lie, if sobriety is nothing but a life destined to be full of grayness and funless days upon days, I'm drinking tonight. And I want to tell you, if you're new and you're listening to this and you're having that early sobriety doldrums and your brain is telling you, well, this is how I'm going to feel. This is what I get for being a craphead alcoholic. It's going to suck forever. It's a lie. And I'm going to give you another word that you can carry with you and you pull it out when you need to, because my sponsor gave me this when I was new and I used to pull it out a lot. Temporary. He said, if you do what we ask you to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, we promise you this grayness in your life, this irritable, restless, discontent nature in your life, it'll be temporary. And boy, isn't that the truth. Because all the promises came true for me. Life means something to last. My imagination is fired. I can't wait to see what'll happen next. And I couldn't see that happening when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I certainly couldn't see that happening when I was trying to get sober on my own. You see, the doctor's opinion in the big book describes what happens to a guy like me after a short period of recovery. And it's, you know, it sounds clinical the way that Silkworth wrote it in there. And he says, you know, we become irritable, restless, and discontent. And it doesn't sound half bad. I think it's the greatest understatement in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it doesn't feel that way. Irritable. I want to hurt you. Restless. I think I'll go over there. Nope, I don't like them. Maybe I'll go over there. Nope, they don't like me. Maybe I'll get some ice cream. God, I'm getting fat. Doesn't matter what I'm doing, where I'm doing it, and who I'm doing it with. I'm in the wrong place doing the wrong thing with the wrong people. I just can't find that place where I fit. I'm restless, and I'm discontent. And boy, if you'd asked me when I was new what kills alkies, I would have said whiskey and car crashes. And I won't say that today. Today I say discontent. Because let me tell you, if I ever leave a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, if I ever repeat the desperate experiment of the first drink, you bet your bottom dollar I was discontent for a while before that happened. So we have to really, you know, and discontent or content are very confusing for us, you know. We think we're talking about happy or unhappy, and we're not. Look, Matt, happy and unhappy, that's kind of the state of life. That's everybody goes through that. I can live with that. Happy and unhappy seem to be influenced by things outside of myself. You know what I mean? How's the economy? How's the weather? How's my wife's mood? Whatever, you know. But contentment or discontentment are far more powerful. You know what alcoholics like? You know what we're good at? You know what we're better at than any group of people I've ever met? Doing wrong. I mean, we do wrong better than anybody I've ever met. You know, we're good when things are, when our back's up against it, we do conflict well. Give us something to point to. Give us a bad medical diagnosis, a reversal of fortune, a broken heart, something that we can point to and go, that's why I'm screwed up. That's why I'm so discontent. That's why I'm pissed off. Give me something to point to that I can blame for the storm raging through me. You know what makes us crazy? When nothing's wrong, but we feel like something's wrong. You know what I'm talking about? You lay in bed at night, like I've done 100 times, man. Laid in bed and thought to myself, oh, I'm sober a long time. Got a home group, got sponsees, got a sponsor. That's going good. Got a wife, says she loves me. She's not going anywhere. And I'm, you know, she's a great gal. I'm really lucky to have her. Money's good. Got no pressing money issues. The job's going good. You know, I really don't have anything to gripe about. My goodness, if it was any better, I'd go in the backyard and hang myself. You know, and we don't know. What the hell? I just knew because, you know, I come to AA with preconceived ideas, right? You know, I come to AA with a loser's resume. I'm hopelessly in debt. You know, I owe the IRS 80 grand. I owe the state of California. I don't know how much. I'm living at my sister's house at age 31. I haven't worked in a year. I don't have a car. Warrants for my arrest in two counties because I'm an overachiever. You know what I mean? And I think when I'm new in AA, if those problems were taken care of, oh my goodness, I'd be so happy. I'd be so happy. I never have a bad day. And if you get sober and you get a sponsor and you go through the steps, you know what happens? You start taking care of that crap. And I remember being 3-4 years sober and I'm out of trouble. I'm out of trouble. The warrants are taken care of. I got a driver's license. I got a car. It's not a good car, but I got a car. Got a little job. It's not a good car, but it's a, you know, not a good job, but it's a job. You know, I had one of those sponsors. I feel so crappy. Well, get a crappy job. So I did. You know what I mean? And it wasn't that it was bad. I don't want you to think it was bad. It just wasn't as good as I thought it was going to be. And that's okay. You know, when I was new in AA, I'd hear you guys, you braggarts, you know, talk about your good life. And, you know, you talk about having a career, right? And I think, man, what's that like? I had one, but I burned it to the ground. And you would talk about going to work and being part of a team. You know, and thinking it was an honor and a privilege to be a service at your place of employment. I don't know anything about that. I'm a taker, man. And you would talk about being returned to life, being returned to citizenship and voting in elections and becoming a homeowner and finding the woman of your dreams and having a healthy relationship. I don't know anything about that stuff. And I would think, man, that'd be a miracle if those things came to pass in my life. I can't even imagine what that would be like. And I wake up and I'm 8-9 years sober. You know what I mean? And I'm married to the beautiful Eileen and I've got a great career and I become a homeowner. And I'm a guy in AA that you point to and you go, that guy is a good example. And it's not that it was bad. I don't want you to think it was bad. I just thought it would be better. And you start to understand that recovery from alcoholism has very little to do with people, places, and things. That the spiritual malady has to be overcome before the mental part of the program and the physical part of the program. That spiritual progress must always precede material progress. But I, like many of us, fall victim to a belief that I'm brainwashed and I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous that if the material is taken care of, then I'll be happy. And it ain't bad to have the material taken care of. If you show up here like I did and you don't have two nickels to rub together and you're hopelessly in debt, let me tell you, it's a big deal to be able to feed yourself. It's a big deal to be able to have shelter. It's a big deal to be able to have a steady employment. I mean, I was proud of all those things, but they got nothing to do with recovery from what's going to take me back to the next drink. Because what I found out is I could have a fat bank account, a nice car, a beautiful wife, a good house, a great home group, all the things, all the boxes checked, and I could still be irritable, restless, and discontent, sober for years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I start to understand that just one day at a time thing means more than just going to bed sober that night. But I arrive in Alcoholics Anonymous in that state of failure, in that state of the complete and utter loss of faith in my human powers. And I don't know what to do. And I don't come to AA to get sober. I know that all of you good people did. But I came here because I couldn't think of anything else to do. You know what I mean? Because I'm dishonest to the bone. So to say that I had an honest desire to stop drinking, no way. I have an honest desire to get out of trouble. I have an honest desire for you to give me another chance. I have an honest desire for you, my sister, not to throw me out of the house. And maybe if she thinks I go to AA, she won't throw me away. And that's how I am when I come to AA, for the worst motives, which is great because motives don't matter. Why we get here doesn't matter. Why we stay is very important. And the reason I stayed is because I was 12-stepped in Alcoholics Anonymous my second night of recovery. And it was in a little place in Southern California called the Simi Valley Alano Club. I don't remember my first night of recovery. I was there, but they tell me I was there and entertaining. You know what I mean? But I was detoxing really hard. I don't really remember it. But I remember my second night because I hit the lottery. You know what I mean? Sitting there minding my own business between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club, and I am coming out of my skin. And I didn't look that night the way I look tonight. You know what I mean? I got hair down in the middle of my back and it's filthy. I got a full beard with food stuck in it. I'm wearing my sunglasses at night. You got to understand, I'm 6'5", 280 pounds. I'm a big man, right? I'm sitting there with my arms folded, my tough guy radar out, just daring you to come talk to me. And nobody is coming to talk to me in the Simi Valley Alano Club because I am dangerous. And I'm dangerous because I'm terrified, right? Anybody terrified is dangerous. And I'm looking at you. And you don't look like me. You're clean and you're happy and you're smiling and you're drinking coffee and you all know each other. And I just, you're repellent because I'm at the low point of my existence and I'm looking at AA and I'm judging all of you. And my head's talking to me like, what are we doing here? Man, why do you do this to us? Oh, you're getting sober again. And now you're doing it in AA like that's going to be any different. Why do you do this, Don? You know what's going to happen. You're going to take the pain for as long as you can, maybe a couple of days, maybe a week. Maybe you'll stretch it to 2 weeks. And then what are you going to do? You're going to drink anyway. Huh, I got an idea for your scooter. Why don't we get out of this joint and go get a drink? You know you're going to do it anyway. Let's go get a drink. Let's go right now. This isn't going to work. Every molecule in my body is screaming in unison to go get a drink. And I decide to leave AA. And I'm not leaving AA because it doesn't work or God doesn't exist or steps aren't a miracle or any of the stuff that we talk about. I'm leaving AA because I don't have the human power to overcome an obsession of my mind that demands another drink. You see, I've lost the power of choice. The dumbest thing we say to newcomers is, we don't drink no matter what. I tried that for 5 or 6 years. It damn near killed me. Okay? See, I got to go drink. I'm in the clutches of King Alcohol. It's not a choice. I can't take the pain of sobriety. And I'm leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's going to cost me everything. I want to be clear about that. It's going to cost me my place of residence, the last relative on the planet that loves me. And it's probably going to cost me my life. But you know what? Small price to pay. If it'll make the madness in my head stop for 15 minutes, I'm willing to pay that price because I can't take the pain of sobriety. And I'm leaving. And these two good members of Alcoholics Anonymous happen to see me. And although it's the most important moment of my life, whether I live or die will be decided in the next few minutes. For Mark and Lou, it was Tuesday. You know what I mean? And they were where they were every Tuesday night between the 6 o'clock and the 8 o'clock meeting at the Simi Valley Alano Club. They hung out together, and they drank AA coffee, and they told those AA war stories and those off-color jokes, but most importantly, they had their eyes trained on the room and had their eyes trained on the door, and they always looked for men to 12-step, and they saw me, and they took what I think is the most important action we'll ever take in a meeting hall of Alcoholics Anonymous. These two good men walked 30 feet across the clubhouse to cordially welcome a man to AA who was dying from the disease of alcoholism. And they did it the way we do it. Hi, I'm Mark. This is Lou. We don't think we've met you. Why don't you come sit with us? And I received the first spiritual invitation I ever received in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've received tens of thousands of spiritual invitations from our society since then. But that first one might have been and probably was the most important. Without that invitation, none of the other ones are possible. And you invite me. That's what you do in AA. That is the main spiritual principle we operate under in the 12th step, the spirit and the principle of invitation. And they invited me to sit with them, and I sat with these men. And Lou told me, Don, this is Mark. He'll be your sponsor. And then he walked away. So they assigned me my first sponsor in AA. And I know that's not done everywhere, but I got to tell you, we might want to rethink that. You know, it's a crazy thing we do with sponsorship, isn't it? Right? We take the sickest person in the room, and then we leave them to make the most important decision of their life. I'm a guy that wouldn't know good recovery if it slapped me around the face, but you want me to pick the sponsor. And what do we say to the new people? Well, find somebody that has what you want. Huh. Interesting advice. What do I want my second night of recovery? Oh, I don't know. Maybe a pharmaceutical rep with a spare Cadillac. I mean, it's a beginning, right? Because I'd have never picked the guy that they assigned to me because he's not like me. He's small of frame. He's quiet of voice. He's bald of head. He's wire-rimmed glasses. And he loves God. You know what I mean? And I don't believe in God. And my first sponsor, the night I met him, he's talking about God. That thing that people say in AA, well, I don't talk to new men or women about God till they get their feet underneath them. He didn't get that memo because our first conversation was laced with his belief in God and laced with what God had done for him, what God had done for you, what God had done for them, what he's expecting a miracle, and I'm the lucky one. Isn't this great? Isn't that something? I'm at the low point of my existence. This guy's looking me right in the eye. He just met me, and he's telling me I'm one of the lucky ones. He's saying stuff like, they're out there in the streets tonight, Don, and they're dying, and somehow you made it to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're one of the lucky ones. Everything's going to be okay. And I had no intellectual reason to believe what he said, but when he said it to me, for some reason, I felt better. And I got my first little bit of hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all hope is, man. Hope is this idea that it's going to turn around and you got no argument to support it. It's a feeling. And when I was with Mark that first night and every night I was with him afterwards, I felt hopeful. And you know why? Because he believed. And when you're with somebody that believes and they're armed with spiritual enthusiasm, it cuts through your fear. It cuts through your prejudice. It cuts through your resentment. This guy got me excited about Alcoholics Anonymous the first night he met me, and I didn't know that's what he was doing because he was just doing his 12-step obligation. He did that. I watched him do that with tons of guys since but I didn't know this man. I didn't know that was a way of life for him. I didn't know that he thought the most important thing in his life was carrying the message to the alcoholic that still suffers. I didn't know that I had hooked up with a guy who used to say, to the degree I'm willing to be inconvenienced for my fellow alcoholic, that's the true degree that I walk with God. I didn't know any of that, and I didn't need to because he knew it. And he invited me. He used that spiritual principle. He invited me. See, there's things when you get an active member of AA as a sponsor that happen automatically, and I didn't know any of this. I just got lucky, right? See, he's active, which means I'm going to be active if I'm willing to have it. Because he's active, he has a home group, which means I'm going to have a home group if I'm willing to have it. He has commitments, little tethers that tie him to the program, keep him from blowing away, which means I will have these commitments, these tethers, if I'm willing to have it. He has a whole host of friends because he's active in AA. I didn't realize that when you get a sponsor, you inherit all their friends. Now, when you're new, this does not feel like an asset. I want to be clear. What it feels like is there's a bunch of strangers up in your business. You know what I mean? It's like, why are these people so interested in me? You know, but think about it this way. I'm at the low point of my existence, right? Nobody in the world wants anything to do with me. I burn my life to the ground and suddenly I meet this new group of people and they're going to find out everything about me, good and bad, pretty quickly. Yet they still love me and accept me. Where do you get that kind of understanding and compassion except Alcoholics Anonymous? I mean, that's the thing about AA, right? We meet the alcoholic where he's at. I mean, we understand, you know, and like my sponsor said to me, he goes, look, we know you took a long, long, dangerous walk into some dark, dangerous woods. We did the same thing, but here's the difference. You walked in alone, but you're walking out with us because we're Alcoholics Anonymous and we know the way. So take our hand and hold on tight because we lose a lot of guys on the way out. We don't want to lose you. So stay close. But he promised me that he knew the way out. You see, he met me where I was at. He didn't wait for me to get my stuff together. He didn't wait for me to get 30 days. He put me into action because that is the walk out of the dark woods. He put me into action because that is recovery from alcoholism. He didn't say, let's wait till you get 30 days. I mean, he was like, but he used the invitation. You see, he started to take me through all three sides of the triangle simultaneously without telling me that's what he was doing. Because he used the invitation. Don, hey, listen, I got to show up early tomorrow night and set up this meeting. I could really use your help. And I would think to myself, wow, my sponsor needs my help. That's pretty cool. And I'd say, sure, anything for you, sponsor. And I'd show up early. Right? And we'd set up the meeting, and then he'd shake my hand. He'd say, hey, man, I really appreciate it. Good job. And by using the invitation, he left me with a little dignity. He left me with a little self-esteem of the right kind. You know, a feeling I was pulling my own weight, a feeling that I was a part of, a feeling like maybe it was okay to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did that to me time and time again. You see, he pulled me into his already vibrant AA life. He wasn't a used-to guy. He wasn't a guy that could tell you what he used to do in AA. He was currently taking the actions. So all he had to do was invite me along. Do what I do, go where I go, and you'll get what I get. What do you get? Well, if you do what I do, you won't have to ask that question. You know, we're big philosophers in AA. You know what I mean? We don't like to explain ourselves to new people. He didn't like to explain himself to me. And you do what I do, you'll get what I get. What does that mean? But you know what? I did what he did and I got what he got. I got sober. I got free. And I didn't see it coming. I tell you, there's a great little line in the chapter to employers, man, and it should be our battle cry. And this is the line. Shouldn't we be more interested in results rather than methods? Oh my God, I love that. Because that's AA, man. Because if you're waiting for the methods to make sense, good luck. But the results are undeniable. You know how it is. You call your sponsor up and you're like, whatever. You know, she broke your heart. You lost the job. You're getting sued. Whatever it is. And they go, yeah, man, that sounds tough. Listen, hey, are you working with any new guys? You're not listening to me. Hey, look, I know you loved her. I know she's your soulmate. And I know she left you for your brother. I get it. That hurts. I need you to pick up this new guy and take him to the meeting. I want to kill you. You know what I mean? It's like, how does that have anything to do with recovery from alcoholism? And you see, here's the deal. If you get a sponsor that understands the propulsion system for untreated alcoholism and they've read the book, they know that we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-delusion, and self-pity. Any one of those things can kill us. You put them together, right? It's a brutal cocktail. It'll take us out every time. And one thing I know about AA is we will not tolerate self-pity. Now, what that looks like to the untrained eye sometimes is we don't have compassion. We don't have empathy. And nothing could be further from the truth. AA is the most loving place I've ever been, but we know that self-pity kills alcoholics. Poor me, poor me, pour me another drink, right? So when my sponsor found out about the facts of my life and the trouble I was in, he didn't try to talk me out of it. He made fun of it. He didn't say, oh, that's okay. You stay sober. God loves you. It'll all work out. No, he'd say things like this. Nah, you got a terrible life. You're right, kid. Horrible life. He goes, I make a gratitude list every night. You're on it. I write down, and God, thank you that I'm not Don. And then he'd laugh and laugh and laugh. He found out I owed the IRS $80,000. That's not a big deal. You got a half a million in the bank. Write the check. But when you're brand new in AA and your first job is working construction, where you suck so bad, you have a nickname on the job site, the bleeder, and you're making minimum wage with taxes taken out, you're not hopeful to ever get out of debt. And my sponsor didn't try to make me feel better about it. He goes, yeah, man, that's a lot of money. That could take some time. He goes, but that's not nothing to do with recovery from alcoholism. Maybe you'll just be broke and sober and happy. That's not bad. Would you settle for that compared to how you've been living? And it made sense. I'm like, yeah. But he took that bit of information and he put it into service in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because whatever you got that you bring to us, we'll put it to service. And for the next couple of years until I paid that money off, if any newcomer had the audacity to complain about their little $1,000 IRS debt to my sponsor, he'd say, hold that thought, Jimmy. Hey, Don, you got a minute? And I'd go over like some big dummy unsuspecting. He'd go, Don, tell Jimmy how much you owe the IRS. And I'd turn to Jimmy and I'd go, I owe the IRS $80,000. And Jimmy would go, Jesus. And my sponsor would laugh and Jimmy would feel better and I'd get to be of service. And I learned to laugh at my own misfortune. And I learned to take responsibility. I learned that it was no big deal, that we all come here with stuff. And making mistakes isn't the problem. It's defending them that turns out to be the problem. And I went through the process of those steps. And it had the desired effect. I was a guy that went into the steps convinced there was no God. And I came out of the steps with that wonderful recognition that we have. I think it's the greatest moment an alcoholic can have in their recovery. And hopefully for us, it happens pretty early. And we just think this, oh my God, it's true. You know, cause the first step is really about the trouble I'm in, isn't it? It's understanding that I'm going to drink again. There's no hope in the first step. If you work the first step and you're hopeful, work it again. You've done it wrong. It should scare the hell out of you. You know, the short form of the first step is this. We are screwed. That's the first step, right? It's not if we're going to drink. It's when we're going to drink. And the second step is the beginning of hope because we don't believe it. But the step doesn't say we have to believe it. It says we're going to come to believe that power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And they're talking about the first drink. Restore us to sanity where the first drink is concerned. For me, to drink in spite of everything that's happened to me is plain insane. I need to, as an alcoholic, I need to have a sane reaction to alcohol, which is what? It's described in the 10th step. I recoil as from a hot flame if I'm tempted, right? That's a sane reaction for a guy like me. Oh, no, I'm not. That's a sane reaction, but I don't have it when I'm new. But I come to believe because it happened for you, it could happen for me. And that's all the second step is. It's the beginning of hope. Maybe it could happen for me. And here's the second step prayer, right? Oh, God, I hope it's true. I need it to be true. Because if it ain't true, I'm screwed. Because I believe the first step. And we want it to be true. And let me tell you, when you go into the rest of the steps wanting it to be true, it's a different angle of approach. You get rid of that intellectual pride where I'm going to prove this stuff doesn't work. I'm going to prove that it doesn't make a difference. And suddenly you're like, oh, man, it better be true. Because if it ain't, I'm in trouble. And that's why we take the third step, because we make a decision to what? I'm going to have a relationship with this power that my sponsor tells me changed his life. You told me changed your life. She told me changed your life. I can't find anybody in AA who's not saying the same damn thing. I had a terrible life. I was a horrible loser. Everybody hated me. Now I'm free, and it's because of God. Some variation of that, right? We use our own words and experience. Everybody's saying it. You can't be having another set of meetings where you're getting together to form a lying committee to the newcomer. And I begin to understand if it happened for you, maybe it could happen for me. And it happens to all of you. Bill Wilson referred to it as what? A wholesale miracle. It's a miracle. But it's a miracle that's repeatable with a certain set of actions. It's remarkable. And I do the steps 4 through 9 for what? To have that relationship. That's all steps 4 through 9 are. It's an exercise in preparing myself, removing things, getting in spiritual shape to have a relationship with that power. Doesn't mean I'm going to be good at the relationship. It just means I will have one. I will have a spiritual awakening. I will awaken to the fact that this power is real. I had been asleep to that fact previously. Now I'm awake. Now what's the trick? Don't go to sleep. And how many times have I spiritually fallen asleep in my sobriety? Oh my God. Asleep at the Wheel in AA by Don L. I mean, my God, where I'd been in the middle of AA. You know that feeling, water everywhere and nothing to drink, going to meetings, sponsoring people, giving talks, disconnected from God. That's tough duty, man. I've been there. Don't go to sleep. That's what steps 10 and 11 are about. They're the don't go to sleep steps, right? They shoot us back into all the other steps. And you start to realize the steps don't go like this. They go like this. It's a circle. It's a way of life. And you begin to understand that's why they call the design for living three places in the big book. This is where I'm supposed to work out the answer to the question of my life. What's the question of your life? How to live life on life's terms and not put whiskey in my gut. How do you do that? How do you do that with a sense of freedom, happy, joyous, and free living? 12 steps. But I got to do them all the time. And that's what I found out. You see, I want it to be a curriculum, don't you? Don't you want to just work the steps really hard for like 6 months and get your little AA diploma and graduate into spirituality and skip down the road and not have to do this anymore? Not how it works. It's one day at a time, right? And I used to think that meant stay sober one day at a time. And it does. But here's the other thing, man. I can have a great spiritual day and build a beautiful spiritual structure. Tomorrow, it's not worth anything. Or I can have a terrible spiritual day. We've all had those. I've had plenty of those. You know what a terrible spiritual day is like? Here's how you know. You do an 11-step review at night. You're thinking about your day. And you have this question. You think to yourself, there must have been other human beings there today. There must have been. And you can't remember any of them because you're in the prison of self. You know what I mean? You go, boy, that's a bad spiritual day. And that can't hurt me tomorrow. As bad as that was, because whatever spiritual structure I build today, tonight, when I'm asleep, it turns out that my spiritual structures are built out of sand on a beach, and God's going to send the waves in, and I'm going to wake up in the morning to a clean palate. And one day at a time means this today for me. Today's the day I get to choose. Who am I going to serve? Because I'm going to serve somebody, bet your bottom dollar. Don't you hate that when you realize you've always been a servant? You know, I'm either going to serve self or I'm going to serve God and his kids. But bet your bottom dollar I'm serving somebody. So that's the first question. And then it's about using the building blocks. If I decide I want to serve God and his kids, if I decide I want to be an AA, if I decide I want to live a spiritual way of life, start building. What do we use? Prayer, meditation. For what? Preparation. It's just preparation. It doesn't change me. It prepares me. And here's the good news. God doesn't have business hours. I don't just have to do it in the morning and at night. I can stop anytime I want like that. Go time out, close my eyes, and say, hey, God, it's done. How you doing? I'm having a day. Just want you to know I got a little fear going on. It'd be nice if you remove that. Direct my thinking to what you would have me be, and I know that I'll feel better once I'm with you. And I can remember to reconnect with my higher power. I can do that several times each day. You know, the principle behind it is saying many times to ourselves, thy will, not my will, be done. But the way we do it manifests itself very differently. Different forms of prayer and meditation. You know, if you take the labels off what good prayer is and what bad prayer is and what good meditation is and what bad meditation, and you narrow it down to this, did I do it or not? You did it. Yeah, but I only did it. I only prayed for like 30 seconds. I only meditated for like, who cares? You did it. Check the box. It's about consistency more than quality. See, we're judging ourselves and nobody else is. Nobody's coming into my life and going, that wasn't much of a prayer there, Slick. Oh, you call that meditation? But people in AA will make you feel like that because they kind of get a little weird about bragging about their meditation. You know, I make sure I have a quiet place with a gong and a Buddha and I close the drapes and my cat gets in the lotus position with me. And it's like, I don't live there, man. That's not where I live my life. I don't get in any trouble on my knees next to my bed saying good morning to God. I do that, but that's not where my life is lived. I need him in my real day-to-day, moment-to-moment life, right? When I'm interacting with my wife, when I'm interacting with the people I work with, when I'm interacting with the people in the supermarket, how do you do that? spiritual preparation. It's right in the 11th step. They call it the pause. Pause means stop. Pause. Turns out that God's address is the pause. And his language is silence. How do you connect with God? Shut up and sit still. Hardest thing in the world for an alcoholic to do, right? Particularly of my type. Telling me to be quiet and sit still. Oh, I'll do anything but that. But that's where the sweet spot is. Take a deep breath and realize that he's with us, right? You know? And that is how I work out my solution. I've been doing it. I'm better at it today than I've ever been. But here's the good news. I'll be better next year. It's the promise of Alcoholics Anonymous. We grow along these spiritual lines. I don't know of anything else in life where you don't have a plateau. You talk to great musicians, there's a plateau. I was a great athlete, well, in my mind, but I was a pretty good athlete. But there was a plateau. Spiritual way of life, there's no plateau because it's infinite. So we keep growing in usefulness and understanding. And the book says that our next function is to grow in usefulness and understanding, right? This should continue for our lifetime. But this is the question we don't ask. Usefulness in what and understanding what? Well, it's implied, isn't it? Understanding God's will and effectiveness in carrying it out. You see, I'm going to get better at that sixth sense. I'm going to get better at understanding what God's will is for me. And I'm going to get more effective in carrying it out, which is what serenity looks like. When I was new, I witnessed it, but I didn't know what I was looking at. I watched old timers go through stuff. Truck blows up. They go, oh, well. Wife dies. I'm going to miss her. God's will. Kid gets sick. Everybody gets their turn in the barrel. Reversal of fortune. That's okay. I'm still sober. And I'd watch them. Like, is it true? Do they really feel that way? Right? And you realize that not only were they saying, oh, well, they were saying, oh, well, in meaning it. And it blew me away. And I didn't understand it when I was new, but I understand it today. Because I've had every problem that a human being can have because everybody gets their turn in the barrel. It's the conveyor belt of life, right? And the only thing that's changed in my years of sobriety is when those tough times come, I just don't notice them anymore. I don't take them so personal. I don't think God hates me or you hate me. I just kind of get into the solution pretty quickly, like, oh, this sucks. I wonder what I should do. You know, call your sponsor, pray, you know, and you just don't spend a lot of time wringing your hands, wondering why the universe is unfair. It's not like life has changed. It's what you asked me to do when I was new. Try to master, with God's help, my reactions to life rather than trying to change life to suit myself. Life can be anything it wants to be. It's none of my business. My job isn't the thing anymore. My job with God's help is my reaction to the thing. The thing never changes, but our reactions can, and God makes that possible. Hey, thanks for listening. I hope you stay sober forever. Have a great Sunday.